Welcome to After Hours at the Book Club. This is our podcast edition of the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. And we're delighted to have as our first guest in the After Hours studio, Edward Hamlin, who is the author of Night in Urchebbi and other stories. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
So we just did a nice interview with you and about your book. And I want to know, how did you come to writing short stories? You know, why not novels? Why not poetry? Why not essays? Short stories seems like a pretty tough form. So how did you end up focusing on short stories?
Well, I have done all of the above at various times. And I think, you know, I enjoy writing novels. It's tough to break in. It's tough to break in with short stories. That's why I've kind of gone the contest route. But short stories allow you to make something perfect, you know, as close to perfect as a human can make it. It's like you can make your own little Fabergé egg, and a novel, that's pretty tough. It's just, it's too big of a canvas to have every little brushstroke be perfect.
I'm always fascinated by the characters, and particularly characters in short stories, because there are so many. If you're writing a novel, you might have two or three or four protagonists. Mm-hmm. So when you have so many different stories, so many different people in the stories, you got to come up with a lot of names. I'm always curious, how do you pick names that are very authentic? Because you've Anna, Anne, Helen, Walker, Angela, Anna May, which, you know, I found very interesting.
No arson.
Yeah. Not yet. Yeah.
That's my challenge.
I'm still writing. Don't worry. We'll get to you. I don't know. I mean, I sometimes the names change as I write the story.
How integral is the name to the character?
Oh, very. I think it's very important because we have associations with names. And, you know, I just wrote a story about a woman named Sandra. She's in it. Her mother is Charlotte and her son is Curtis. And all the way through the story, I kept thinking, I don't know if I like Kurt. I might have to change out Kurt. But by the end of the story, Sandra convinced me that the right name for her son was Kurt. It's an ear thing.
How much do you write for yourself, your own ear, and how much are you aware of, like, I want to create something that's really going to resonate with a lot of people? Or do you trust that if it resonates with you, it will resonate with a lot of people?
I think the latter. If you do your emotional work honestly and well, you're going to write something that people respond to emotionally. I mean, I sometimes have written stories, you know, what they would have used to call about speeches, occasional speeches, right? I've written stories for a specific contest or, you know, with a particular person in mind. But that's the exception, not the rule.
In the book, you tackle a few current events, but kind of sideways. Like in One Child Policy, you know, that you have a Chinese immigrant who's really beaten to a pulp by a skinhead in New York City. So kind of a comment on immigration in this country. You have another story where the main character, her brother has died in the war. And so she's facing trauma, which seems to be a sideways comment again on the wars. How much can your political convictions enter into these stories, or are you careful not to be too overt?
You know, I think it would ruin the story if it were overtly political. Although I have to say, great writer Jim Shepherd commented about the stories that they were politically astute. And when I saw that, it really spun my head around because I never, ever thought of the stories as political. And that's silly. When I go back and I look at them objectively, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, there's capital punishment is in there. The Iraq and Afghanistan wars are in there. There's plenty of stuff that's political. And sometimes not even my politics, you know, Northern Ireland, the Troubles are in there. But I'm very wary of taking sides. I think good fiction comes from the gray areas. And if you take sides, you're risking just ruining a story.
Well, you mentioned Northern Ireland. That's in the backstory of one of the protagonists, Maeve, who's actually in Brazil, but she's originally from Belfast. You said you've been there. I mean, did you meet characters that seem to have this past? I mean, were you there during the Troubles or after the peace agreement when people maybe are less likely to divulge their past? People have tried to move on a bit.
Well, the roots of that story are kind of interesting. I worked for a Northern Irish company for about 3 years, based in Belfast on Airport Road. and founded by a 30-something Protestant guy who grew up in the estates, as they call them over there, public housing, and a Catholic guy whose grandfather had been in the original IRA in the 20s or 30s. And this was a company that involved, you know, Catholics, Protestants, a lot of Brits, a lot of English people working there. And as an American going into it, you know, I felt an obligation to bone up on the history. And I read a number of books about the Troubles. And I really, I mean, not with writing in mind whatsoever, but just because these were my coworkers. And of course, you keep wondering in the back of your mind, like, where were you in 19, you know, when that bomb went off? You know, I stayed in the Europa Hotel, which was the most bombed hotel in Europe, apparently, during the Troubles. And so I had a lot of imagery and a lot of curiosity about the cultural world around the Troubles, but there are a lot of questions I couldn't ask coworkers. There's a real boundary there. And I mean, it would come out in funny ways. You know, I joined the company through an acquisition where the company acquired an American company. And their HR director, who is a sort of a flamboyant Northern Irish woman, came to Chicago to do an onboarding, you know, a training, and to introduce people to the benefits the company offered and all that. And one of my less well-informed coworkers raised his hand and said, "So, you have a 401k. Now, I have an IRA. Now, do you guys, is there a way that I can take my IRA and convert it into your 401k?" And of course, the HR director had no idea what an IRA was in the American sense, but there was a kind of a cognitive dissonant moment there that was awfully fun.
Well, in terms of characters, I mean, you talked there about meeting so many characters that you were just dying to find out mm-hmm. their real backstory. And obviously, then as a writer, you have this wonderful imagination and you bring it to the page. But I think we've all met people that you know they've got this amazing story. I mean, yeah. Do you find yourself trying to probe people with a view to maybe having them, or maybe it's a subconscious thing, but, you know, maybe having them as a character in a yeah. story?
Well, yes, but I would never do it to anyone who's listening to this podcast, of course. I mean, I pick up bits and pieces every single day, and I do take notes when I think I won't remember it. Sure. I mean, I have my notebook. I listen to people. I watch people. I'm very, you know, I like writing dialogue. And so I have an ear. I'm a musician, too. And, you know, it's been pointed out to me that, you know, an ear for music might help with an ear for dialogue. And so I do listen a lot to people.
I'm glad you mentioned dialogue, because that's one of the things that really jumped out. It's very authentic. And I'm always amazed, obviously, nobody who's been part of the Radio Book Club has written inauthentic dialogue, but so many writers do. And I always feel disconnected when I read that. And it's like, nobody yeah. would say that in real life. Nobody yeah. would have this type of conversation.
Well, it can throw you out of the book. Yeah. As soon as you start saying, as soon as you start questioning that dialogue, you're not in the book anymore.
That's right. And you know, this there were a lot of dialect challenges in writing this book. We have everything from, you know, Northern Irish, a bit of Northern Irish dialect. I mean, the opening page of the book has, you know, things like a scene where some IRA men are putting rifles in the boot of the car. Right. So I've often wondered, you know, readers who pick that book up on the first page, do they even know what I'm talking about?
That's so funny, because I read it and obviously I did know, and I didn't notice that wasn't in sort of
well, you wouldn't.
The trunk or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. I live my life in that gray area. We're always using the wrong term.
I bet you do. But, you know, I had The Boy Unleashed is all told in sort of backwoods Ozarks dialect. Thankfully, I do have Southern family who are not backwoods Arkansas people, but, you know, were able to help me with a little bit of that. I am very careful about fact-checking dialogue when I'm not sure. And, you know, one of the things that I think about sometimes is, you know, my first book was published when I was 55 years old, right? So some interviewers have said, well, do you feel bad that it's taken you 55 years to publish your first book? And yes and no, but one of my reflections on it is I now am old enough that I have a great network of people. And so if I'm writing a story about Morocco, I have a dear old friend who spent a lot of time in Morocco. I can call her up or send her a manuscript and say, you know, help me with this. Did I get this right? So almost every story I write, I have kind of alpha readers, you know, first readers who I will ask sometimes when I'm writing if I'm unclear about something, but then I'll have them read it and just, you know, check it for accuracy and dialect and all these little nuances that, as you said, Arson, you know, can throw you out of the story if you're not careful.
Do you, you know, you take some real chances with your characters. You know, you're writing a lot of stories from women's points of view. Mm-hmm. You have this Ozark point of view. You don't really have too many 55-year-old guys living in Boulder who grew up in Chicago point of view. I know. So do you ever feel sometimes you're out on a limb? Have you thrown out stories saying, you know, I just can't pull this off?
I actually don't throw out stories very often anymore, thankfully. I mean, I can usually bring them, you know, get them off the operating table if they're having a crisis. But I like taking the risks. I really do. That's half the fun for me. And there are, you know, one or two stories in the book that are a little closer to my world, like The Release, you know, is about sort of middle-class white family. And I'm writing more stories like that now. I finished a second collection, and that has sort of more characters are closer to my life, but not all. You know, I've got a lot of stretches in there, too.
Who do you like to read? What fiction writers really turn you on?
So, all kinds of people. I mean, I'm, you know, yeah. Start in reverse. I mean, at the moment, I'm really into Tessa Hadley.
I love Tessa Hadley.
Yeah, who's a wonderful.
We would do anything, Tessa Hadley, to get you on the show.
Tessa, if you're listening,
yes.
Contact info is underneath.
And can you invite me for that? Yeah, I'll bring wine, whatever it takes. But I'm really enjoying Tessa Hadley. I've been reading, you know, books of friends. I mean, I recently finally read B.K. Lorenz's Theft, which is a fabulous book.
Featured on the radio book club.
Rebecca Mackay, I just, you know, spent some time reading her books. So I've been doing that. And now, God forbid, I seem to have joined a meetup group dedicated to reading all of Proust.
Wow.
Which I've read 3/4 of Proust. And, you know, this is silly, but I'm really conflicted about it because I absolutely love Proust. I'm, you know, it's one of my favorite writers ever. But I know that taking that on is going to take time away from reading all the contemporary stuff that I'm way behind on.
That's so, my life.
Yeah,
you know, at the bookstore. I mean, I can't, you know, I just got in just yesterday. I got new books by Zadie Smith. Mm-hmm. Ian McEwan came in. Robert Coover.
Yeah.
I opened my mail yesterday. I had those three books in it.
Yeah.
So do you get stressed, Arson? Because, I mean, I do. I get simultaneously excited and then totally stressed about the fact that there are these fabulous books out there that I don't have time to read all of them. And they keep getting published like every day. Tomorrow, you're going to get an equally fabulous batch of books.
It'd be nice if there were a moratorium in
publishing.
I have to catch up.
Well, I kind of did look at the stack yesterday. Michael Chabon had a new book out too. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that stack yesterday and I thought, I wonder which one will still be on my to-be-read shelf 3 years from now. You know, like which one won't I get to? But, you know, it's great to have all these new books coming out. And it's impossible to keep up, so I don't feel the guilt anymore. I felt guilt 10, 15 years ago when I hadn't been in this job quite as long. But now I just realize I'm never going to catch up, you know?
I think, I'd say two things. One is I've been in desperation. I've been just going backwards and reading the Pulitzer and National Book Award and National Book Critics Circle Award books because a lot of those I missed. And so I've been doing that just as a framework. It's probably like biasing my reading terribly against, you know, emerging authors like myself. But the other thing is there are certain authors that I just automatically will read their latest book. Anthony Durr, Colin McCann. I mean, I'm going to read those books no matter what, and they will jump ahead in the queue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've read everything Zadie Smith has written. Mm-hmm. So that's going to go way up.
I've read White Teeth, I think, 10 times. I mean, I don't reread books that often because there's so many new books to read, but I just love that book so much.
Yeah, and the Ian McEwan book, I really love Ian McEwan, and this book has such a strange premise. It's basically an updating of Hamlet, but the Hamlet is basically a fetus in his mother who overhears his mother-to-be having an affair with his father's brother and plotting to kill the father. So that's what's good. I mean, I just know the thumbnail sketch of this book. It's Ian McEwan. I'm sure somehow he pulls it off, but it seems so odd.
Yeah.
So many books to read. That's why I'm glad short story writers like yourself, Edward Hamlin, are out there to give us bite-sized pieces that I don't feel, you know, I need to stay up till three in the morning to get to the end.
You know, that I'd be so curious to hear your perspective on this, Arson, given your role in life. But everyone says short stories don't sell, short story collections don't sell, but obviously, it's the golden age of the short story. It's the latest golden age of the short story. You have, you know, Redeployment winning the National Book Award. You have George Saunders. You have some stunning examples of wonderful short stories out
there. His book sells like crazy.
And the Story Prize books.
Yeah.
You know, incredible stuff. But they are hard. It's hard to get an agent with a short story collection. That's the first locked door.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the business of writing, because you talked earlier about...
Do we have to?
Well, just, you know, from an outsider's perspective, you talked about, you know, having to cull down, you know, a story from, I don't know how many, 8,000 words to fit it into whichever, you know, the parameters of either a short story competition or having it published. Is that just something you do in your own? Do you work with an editor? Because I've really heard the importance of working and having a great partnership with an editor when you're doing this process?
Yeah, I did a little bit of that on specific stories, like Boy Unleashed was first published in the Bellevue Literary Review. And Danielle Ofri is the editor. She's just an incredible, has an incredible sense of prose. And we worked together on a number of things in that story. I didn't take all of her advice, and when the story, got included in the collection later, I was at liberty to, you know, make a few changes of my own because she was no longer my editor. So I've had some good experiences like that. I've never worked with a developmental editor.
What does that mean?
Well, an editor that gets involved when you're just beginning to develop a book. I don't know if it would work for me, frankly. And my writing process is so, you know, I'm not a writer who writes a very rough first draft and then goes back and starts really working on it. I write a pretty clean first draft. I mean, Night in Urg Chebbi, the title story, was written in two sittings, I think, and I did very, very little revision on it. So I revise as I go, and I don't know that that would lend itself to, here's a big, messy first draft. Now let me bring in an editor to help me clean it up.
You have these stories in your head. Is the messy first draft in your head? Are you living with that story for a while, and then by the time you get to the page, it's been revised and revised in your head?
So one of the most tricky things, and I've said this in writing, you know, teaching writing, one of the most tricky things is knowing when to start writing with a story, because you'll have a germ of a story in your head. And I found through painful experience that if I wait too long, if I got it too worked out ahead of time, if I know the ending in great detail, the writing is going to sound like a newspaper. It's just reporting almost, as I'm just transcribing stuff. And it lacks a certain energy than if I go into it when I don't know all the details. I'm not sure where it's going. Only lately have I started using a notebook to kind of spin out different ideas for a story. And that's been actually kind of helpful. But if I go back and I look at the notes for the last three or four stories I've written, the way the story turned out bears almost no relation to what I thought was going to happen. I think those are the best stories.
How does this relate to that? I think it's a pretty common field of thought. I think if people are familiar with the book The Artist's Way, where it's like just the physical act of writing. It doesn't matter if you think you've nothing to write. Just start writing stuff down and that will get the creative juices flowing. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that part of the process, or are you like, I'm going to think about this a little bit more and then when I'm ready I'll write down?
Yeah, it's a very subtle process, and I suppose it's been part of my maturation as a writer over the last year or two. I'm a late bloomer in that, but I'm getting better at knowing when to start. And sometimes, I mean, I still have a day job, you know, so I have to write in slots in my week. And sometimes it's problematic because I'll have carried the story to the point where it's the ideal moment to sit down and start writing, but I can't. I have too much work to do, or I'm traveling for work or something. So it's a balancing act.
Well, we have been after hours at the book club here on this podcast. The Radio Book Club is a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. After hours, it's a new segment. This is our first one. And I think, Arsene, our idea was to get some questions that maybe aren't appropriate to ask on air.
Yeah, and just see where the conversation
goes. Yeah, well, I have one that's completely unrelated to books. But what's your favorite binge-worthy TV that you are watching, either on Netflix or Amazon or one of these TV streaming things? I mean, we're talking about having not enough time to read all these books.
Yeah, but now we're back to that competition. Yeah, that problem. And I quite honestly, streaming video in your home is a terrible competition for reading. It's terrible. I will admit. I think, we got very deep into this French cop procedural called Spiral. I absolutely loved it. To the point where, Netflix had acquired 4 seasons of it. We binge watched our way through those over, a period of a few months. And then they couldn't do the deal for the 5th season. So I had to do Googling and research to try to figure out, because I knew it had broadcast in Europe, it had broadcast in Britain. And I'm figuring out, how can I hack and watch it over the internet?
Sounds like a good excuse for a trip to France.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
You just sit in their hotel room and binge watch.
That's right, that's right. Yeah.
Spiral. I'm taking notes because I just wrapped up Broadchurch, which, kept me up very late 2 nights.
And some of the, I'm not saying this just because you're from where you're from, but some of the BBC stuff is fantastic. I mean, Happy Valley.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So you guys are talking another good language. With a 7-year-old in the house, the only thing we're binge watching is Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo's good. Has its merits too. But anyway, there are a lot of books to read and a lot of podcasts to listen to. And so we're hoping you'll spend some time with our book club here after hours, or the official Radio Book Club. You can catch that one, the interview, the formal interview that we did with Edward Hamlin. His latest collection is Night in Urgchebby and Other Stories. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Arsene.
Oh, that was great.